coming up on this week's mini episode of the Drew Perowit Podcast.
When someone has insulin resistance, they are causing their own cognitive decline by multiple mechanisms.
Considering we spend about one third of our day sleeping, wouldn't it make sense that we spend just a little bit of time creating the right environment for a deep night's rest? Let's talk bed sheets in that vein because they're a super important part of a good night's rest. I want to tell you what my dream wish list for everything that I'd want in the perfect set of bed sheets. Number one, comfort. Because if they're not comfortable, nothing else matters. Number two, temperature regulation. So much science is coming out about the importance of keeping your body in the ideal temperature range at night. Not too hot, not too cold. So it's super important to regulate temperature to get that great night's sleep. Number three, non-toxic. So here's the crazy thing. Sleep is supposed to support our natural detoxification process. Why the heck would we want to expose ourselves to additional toxins at night with the wrong set of bed sheets? So I'm pretty pumped to tell you about a brand that meets all these requirements and more. Cozy Earth is my go-to when it comes to the most comfortable, temperature-regulating, and non-toxic sheets on the market. Their bamboo sheets are the softest sheets I've ever freaking slept in. My wife agrees, by the way, and they are hypoallergenic, which means they're naturally antibacterial plus toxin-free. But don't just take my word for it. Oprah Winfrey herself has named Cozy Earth on her top list of favorite things 3 years in a row. And I don't know about you, but I'm Team Oprah all the way. Right now, with you being part of my community, you can get 40% off Cozy Earth sheet set, which is the highest discount they've ever offered. Just head over to CozyEarth.com and use the code DrewPodcast. That's Cozy, C-O-Z-Y, Earth.com with the code DHRU. Podcast, P-O-D-C-A-S-T. If you missed that, it's in the show notes. And if you're on the fence, keep in mind that Cozy Earth's sheet come with a 10-year warranty. So check out CozyEarth.com with the code DrewPodcast. So a while back, I was talking to my dear friend, Dr. Rangan Chatterjee, about this persistent knee pain that I was experiencing, which was super weird because I stretch regularly and I work out at least a few times a week with a big focus on mobility. Now, Dr. Chatterjee asked me a super simple question. He said, could your shoes be causing the problem? That simple but profound question opened an entire rabbit hole for me around the idea that our footwear should conform to our feet, not the other way around. And that's when I discovered Vivo Barefoot, the minimalist footwear company. Vivo Barefoot is unique because it was created from the concept that the human foot is a biomechanical masterpiece, and when left to its own devices, it can thrive. But by cramming our feet into modern shoes, we are really messing with our feet's strength and function, which can have a whole stream of cascading effects. In my case, it was the chronic knee pain that I was experiencing, even though I had top-of-the-line sneakers. So, I switched to Vivo Barefoot and I never looked back. And get this, within 2 weeks, my chronic knee pain completely went away. How crazy is that? What I love about Vivo Barefoot is that it was designed to be wide, thin, and flexible. So you feel as close to barefoot as possible, but with a ton of comfort. They promote your foot's natural strength and movement, and studies have shown that foot strength increases by 60% in a matter of just months just by walking around in them. I honestly can't recommend these shoes enough, and I'm so thankful I found them. Right now, Vivo Barefoot is offering my community 20% off their first order at vivobarefoot.com/Drew. That's Vivo, V-I-V-O, Barefoot, BAREFOOT.com/Drew, DHRU. If you missed that, just click down to the show notes and you'll find it there. I also wanted to let you know that Vivo Barefoot is a certified B Corporation, and it's extremely passionate about using sustainable and recycled materials. They make their footwear in small batches and certain styles are limited. So if you see something you love, don't wait to grab it. And if regular styles are out of stock, you can sign up to get email alerts when it's available again. Plus, Vivo Barefoot offers a 100-day free trial. I know you're going to love these shoes as much as I do. I've been recommending them to everyone I know. Check them out. Hi, everyone. Drew Prode here. Alzheimer's disease is one of the most significant global health threats we face today. It's an ailment that, as our population ages, is forecast to become a worldwide epidemic. Mainstream medicine, obviously doing the best they can, are trying to have us believe that this disease can't be prevented, is untreatable, and most patients will not survive beyond 3 to 11 years post-diagnosis. But this is all being challenged in a healthy way by my guest, Plural, on today's mini episode, Dr. David Perlmutter and Dr. Dale Bredesen. In this episode, we dive into the latest findings in the field of Alzheimer's and dementia, including Dr. Dale Bredesen's study showing that Alzheimer's disease is actually reversible if you get involved early enough and follow a very specific protocol. It could be reversible. That's game changing. We also discuss what it drives. We also discuss what actually drives neuroinflammation and the contributing factors to Alzheimer's disease. Let's listen in, starting with Dr. David Perlmutter, a board-certified neurologist and a five-time New York Times bestselling author. I want to jump right in and talk about Alzheimer's because you wrote a really interesting Instagram post, I think it was a few weeks ago, and you were saying Alzheimer's reversal is real. It's not just a theory. And you were hinting at a new study, a small one, but something exciting that came across your desk that you wanted to highlight and make your audience aware of. So why were you excited about the study and what did they cover inside of there?
Well, I'm hoping you'll share that study with a link. This is work that I've been aware of actually for quite some time. I know you know Dr. Dale Bredesen. And he recently published a book called The End of Alzheimer's, The Plan. You know, the first book was The End of Alzheimer's. This one is The Plan. And I wrote the foreword to that book. And in that foreword, I think it really did capture my excitement about the work that he's doing, even beyond how he's broken the mold beyond Alzheimer's. And let me explain. You know, we live in a world where we try to really pigeonhole our diseases to think that they are caused by one thing and therefore we can fix them with a remedy. And there's such an effort underway to find an Alzheimer's drug that works. Just last month, Eli Lilly announced the results of a trial in which their monoclonal antibody, donanemab, was found to reduce the rate of decline of Alzheimer's patients by an astounding 32%. When they made that announcement, the stock value went up, I think, $20 billion, Eli Lilly. But what does that mean? It means it slowed the decline by a third. It means people are still declining and going to get worse, and we know where it ends up, generally. So it really wasn't stabilizing Alzheimer's, or can you imagine actually improving their situation? Because they're looking at one thing. This is a monoclonal antibody that is targeting this so-called beta amyloid protein that's absolutely the cause of Alzheimer's. Well, we know that study after study has really made it very clear that beta amyloid is almost an innocent bystander. It is the brain's response to various challenges, like infections, for example. So it's sort of like blaming the firemen who arrive on the scene for the fire. It isn't that way at all. And study after study where beta amyloid is targeted have actually been shown to make patients decline more readily. So what Dr. Bredesen is leveraging beyond his results, I'll talk to you about them in just a moment. He's really leveraging the notion of multiple inputs, really kind of the cornerstone of what is called functional medicine, where we don't look at what the disease is that a person has, but rather who is the person who has the disease? What is the unique personalized approach that we can take to understand how that person got that way? Alzheimer's is not just a bioenergetic issue of glucose, lack of glucose utilization in the brain. It's not just that there's beta amyloid, not just that there's a decline in acetylcholine, not just that there's temporoparietal atrophy. There are a lot of things that, you know, roads that lead to Rome here, or as I've said in the past, many, many places to jump on the bus. And I think that if you're going to ever have a shot at reversing Alzheimer's, you have to understand which of the multitude of factors, and Dr. Bredesen has identified more than 36, not just beta amyloid accumulation or type 3 diabetes or underlying herpes infection. Many things have been proposed. But to try to identify in that person who's sitting in your office with declining cognitive function, what's going on with him or her. And then when you figure that part out, then you develop a program that looks at those issues and does its best to correct those issues. Maybe it's lack of supportive hormones. Maybe it's lack of adequate insulin function. You know, so many different things. Cultivate a program that is specific for that patient. Again, we call that personalized medicine. And realize that that can offer up more likelihood of improving that person's situation. So what Dr. Bredesen just published in the study that your viewers can now review is that in a group of individuals who were indeed suffering from mild cognitive impairment or even diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, that when he created this program and people stayed on a personalized program for the 9-month period of time, that 80% of them didn't just stabilize their condition, they improved. You know, he describes patients going back to work, regaining control over their finances. I mean, it's astounding. And, you know, beyond, if that weren't enough, and it is, believe me, it is in my lifetime to see that happen. But if that weren't enough, the idea that he proposes that we should engage this notion of really gaining as much information as we can about an individual and his or her uniqueness prior to initiating therapy. I think we can use that approach, you know, in all walks of medicine. And to be sure, that challenges the mainstream notion of trying to make people fit into the treatment. You know, I often say that a person comes to your office and says, I've been walking 5 miles a day and look at my feet. They're all blistered and torn up. And the doctor says, well, let me write you a prescription for a pair of shoes. And the person gets the prescription filled and they don't fit. It's a size 9 and the man wears a size 11. He comes back and he's complaining. And the doctor says, well, you know, in a study of 10,000 people, size 9 was the average shoe size. So you're going to have to just figure it out. You know, it's very clear that we have to understand the needs of the patients as it relates, in this case, to Alzheimer's disease. There are nutritional issues. There are, you know, a host of lifestyle issues that we've been talking about for years. You and I have had this conversation for a long time that are so incredibly relevant. But yet, you know, the fallback is, well, I'll do what I want, live my life, however, and they'll develop a drug one of these days that'll pull me out of the woods. That isn't reality.
You know, you mentioned these multitude of different pillars that could be contributing. It's not one thing, so the solution is not going to be one thing. Let's talk about those items that contribute to it. You know, you mentioned Dale Bredesen. We've had him on the podcast before. We've gone into his books a little bit. But high level, from what you've seen and kind of leveraging on some of his work, diet gets so much attention, and we'll come back to diet in a minute because that's what one of the main components that you're super known for with your books that you've put out there, because it's something that we can control. Give us the next big bucket that you often see for people that often doesn't get as much attention as diet does when it comes to cognitive decline, dementia, and Alzheimer's.
I'd say that a counter to the notion of you know, what are the big legs that support this decline would be genetics. Genetics is not that relevant. You know, in fact, playing only about a 5% role that, you know, people say, well, I carry the APOE4 allele, therefore I'm at greater risk. But understand that that so-called Alzheimer's gene plays upon other variables that we can absolutely control. So, you know, the point I want to make for your viewers is really quite simple. And that is, if mom or dad had Alzheimer's, or if you know that you, by virtue of your 23andMe or other genetic profile, carry one or two of what are called the APOE4 alleles, which are indeed associated with increased risk for Alzheimer's, all well and good and interesting. No question that having that genetic predisposition and others, presenilin 1, for example, increase your risk. But by all means, the die isn't cast. It means that our choices, we have control over things that are really influential. And I think the biggest issue would be, and they're all important, don't get me wrong, but I think the biggest issue, at least in our modern world, has to do with our metabolism and elevation of our blood sugar, and therefore compromise of our ability to have insulin in the body do its job. And I think, you know, to take a step back, back to high school biology, well, what's the importance of insulin? Insulin is important for getting glucose or sugar into the cell and therefore lowering or regulating blood sugar levels. Well, all well and good, but I think that we have a tendency to be really myopic when we assign our understanding of insulin or other things in the body, other metrics, to a specific area to the exclusion of other functionality. And, you know, for example, we say, well, testosterone is the male hormone. You know, women need testosterone, very important. Progesterone was named because it's pro-gestation. It's the, you know, a female hormone that goes up during gestation. Why would my body have progesterone receptors? I think it's important to expand, in this case, on what insulin does in the human body, and specifically vis-a-vis our conversation now, how does insulin relate to the brain? Well, insulin does play a role in allowing brain energetics. And we'll come back to that in a moment, but it's the way that blood sugar gets into the brain, glucose, to ultimately lead to the powering of the brain cells, the neurons specifically. And that's really important. When our bodies become insulin resistant, and we'll talk about how we get there, I guess I'm paving the way for a lot of conversation, then that functionality, brain energetics, is compromised. That's a bad thing. We can scan brains 20 years ahead of time and determine already when there is compromised brain energetics that is the harbinger for future cognitive decline and ultimately Alzheimer's disease. And that means, tangentially, that, you know, the choices we make in our 30s, 40s, and 50s are very relevant because they, again, portend cognitive decline and full-blown Alzheimer's disease. Other things, however, that insulin does, I think, are very important. For example, we know that insulin is degraded in the brain by something called, oddly enough, insulin-degrading enzyme. Well, it turns out that when we're unable to stimulate adequately this insulin-degrading enzyme because insulin functionality is compromised, that that same enzyme is involved in the degradation of this protein we referred to earlier called beta amyloid. So that's now a connection between insulin and beta amyloid. We know that insulin is important for, again, regulating blood sugar. And why is that important? Because when our blood sugar is elevated, we change our proteins via something called this process of glycosylation, where proteins bind to sugar. And that's an issue because not only does it change what the proteins look like in terms of their three-dimensionality, but it also, because of those changes, alerts the immune system that, hey, here's a protein I've never seen before. And what happens? The immune system gets activated and inflammation gets turned on. And inflammation is really a central player in what degrades the brain in Alzheimer's. So the point I'm making then is regulation, balancing our blood sugar, keeping our blood sugar under control is, while everything is important, I think that might well be perhaps the most important issue, you know, in terms of what throws the widest net, in terms of for your viewers, what they need to pay attention to, that this blood sugar regulation is in the front row, and that we need to do everything we can, getting back to diet. And I know you wanted to move past that, but I chose not to because it's so important, something we all make choices about every single day, unless we're fasting, of course, and everything we can with reference to diet to keep blood sugar levels under control, basically lower than they might otherwise be these days, I think is very relevant. You know, utilizing things like continuous glucose monitoring, checking our blood for ketones, being really aware of fructose in the diet, so many things that influence blood sugar. our sleep patterns, our exercise patterns, sleep as we measure with our wearable devices. All of these things play into balancing blood sugar levels, and the brain is exquisitely sensitive to its provision of its fuel, which is basically glucose. And when that's compromised, when that is threatened, that really does set the stage for future decline.
My next guest, Dr. Dale Bredesen, is an internationally recognized expert in the mechanisms of neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's disease, and he's the author of the New York Times bestsellers, The End of Alzheimer's, The End of Alzheimer's Program, and his latest book, The First Survivors of Alzheimer's. We now know that genetics are not the final say when it comes to cognitive decline. Dr. Bredesen and I talk about the four major groups of insults we need to look at when taking a functional look at neurodegeneration. These include an overload of inflammation and toxins, along with deficiencies in energetics like blood flow and mitochondrial function, and trophics like hormones and nutrients. These are all things we have the power to impact in our daily lives. Let's listen in. You know, a great analogy that I heard is everybody's fallen, scraped their knee or their elbow, and then what happens? Your body is intelligent, right, and a scab will end up being built.
Right.
And nobody would look at a scab and say, hey, what is this thing that's there? It wasn't there previously. Let's start peeling that off.
Right.
And in fact, our approach right now in many aspects of health, but specifically when it comes to cognitive decline and Alzheimer's, is let's give a drug that starts to remove this scab off, yep, which is the amyloid plaque that's there. So the entire focus is on removing something that we see as being foreign that previously wasn't there, but we have to realize that the body has a deep sense of intelligence, and many things it does on purpose, except for rare genetic diseases, which are less than, you know, a small few percentage points of the total diseases that people go through. So we have to ask a bigger question, and that bigger question is, why is the scab there in the first place, and why does the body keep on cutting itself? Right. So in that same analogy and parallel, before we jump into a couple of these stories, give us a couple of the main pillars. You've already mentioned them, but in a way that is translated here so everybody can see the different silos and the pillars that can add up to the cuts that end up happening on the brain. Let's just mention a few of them. So you talked about insulin resistance and blood sugar. So that is often a main one that's talked about. So how is that related to Alzheimer's and our brain health?
Yeah, it's a good point. And as you know, over 80 million Americans have insulin resistance. So it's an incredibly common problem. And so it actually contributes in multiple ways. So if you break down the science, what you find is the thing that actually triggers this change. So APP, the amyloid precursor protein, sits at the center of this and is essentially a master switch. So when things are good, much like the president of our country, when things are good, it sends out signals that say build new interactions. It's a growth period. So your growth and support, and that's what allows you to make and keep memories. On the other hand, this is about neuroplasticity. On the other hand, that same master switch molecule, APP, which sits in your neurons, especially at synapses, and to a lesser extent in non-neuronal cells, this is sampling the environment. And when things are bad, it's literally being cleaved, and it's now sending out a different set of signals that say pull back. And by the way, the analogy is direct to what happened with the pandemic. So we had an insult, in that case, SARS-CoV-2. We were told, okay, we got a shelter in place. We got a social distance. So things pull back. We went into a protective mode, and what happened? We ended up with a recession. The exact same thing is happening in your brain. When you have these various insults, then what happens is you change the signaling from one of growth and maintenance, keeping and making memories, to one of protection. You're now in a protective downsizing mode. You are losing synapses. Your brain is saying, I'm under assault. I can survive by being less of a brain. I'm going to be a smaller brain. I'm going to have fewer synapses. I'm not going to be able to have the same degree of neuroplasticity, but I will be able to survive. And so it's now making the amyloid that is killing, by the way, the bacteria and things like that. This was shown a number of years ago by Professors Robert Moyer and Rudy Tanzi from Harvard. You look at this as a protective mode. Now, just as you said, as long as you keep the insult, you keep making that scab over and over, you keep having the insults, you're going to downsize. So the insults come in four major groups, and you can literally trace the tracks through the molecular pathways of APP. So number one, anything with inflammation. So if you trigger NF-kappa-B, you are going to increase. NF-kappa-B, of course, enters the nucleus, turns on hundreds of genes, and two of the ones that it turns on are the ones that make the A-beta, the beta secretase and the gamma secretase, which cut the APP to make more amyloid. It's saying, ouch, you know, I'm seeing inflammation, I'm going to deal with these pathogens. So that's anything inflammation. And that can be metabolic syndrome. It can be poor dentition. It can be inflammation from chronic sinusitis. It can be any sort of exposure to different pathogens, leaky gut, all of the above. So that's the first one. The second one that's huge is
because what
toxicity.
You're saying is that all that inflammation in the body, wherever it's starting, and we've done a bunch of episodes on dental health and how that's related to body inflammation. All that inflammation will ultimately make its way. It's not just in the body. What you do to the body, you do to the brain.
Exactly. And I think one of the most important understandings is that the amyloid itself is part of the innate immune system. So when we talk about inflammation, we talk about things like NF-kappa-B and cytokines and things like that, the amyloid is itself part of that response. So as long as you've got that ongoing inflammation, you're going to be making that amyloid. So just as people died from cytokine storm with COVID-19, people are dying from cytokine drizzle with Alzheimer's disease. Mm. It is creating over the years this cytokine drizzle. It's a slower process. It's a more chronic process, but it's the same idea. And so, yes, we've got to balance that. We've got to remove the source of that. We've got to first identify the source. What is this? Is this P. gingivalis from your dentition? Is this Lyme disease? You know, is this leaky gut? Is this chronic sinusitis? Is this mold? And whatever it is, we got to identify it. We've got to remove it. That's the key. And then, but absolutely, just as people looked at using things like dexamethasone with COVID-19, you have to think about how can we also quiet down. So we like to use Resolvins, for example, very helpful. But again, without removing the cause of it, you're going to be in trouble down the road. So you've got to look at both what's causing it and then how to deal with what's being produced. So that's the first group. The second group, toxins. And they come in three different subgroups, basically. Number one, anything that is an inorganic, things like mercury and things like air pollution. People who've been in the California fires, it's a big issue, just being exposed to that smoke. The people who were exposed to the World Trade Center, by the way, 14% of them developed cognitive decline by 15 years after that event. So it's a huge player in giving you increased risk for cognitive decline.
Incredible.
Very important. And then the second group is the organics. So things like glyphosate and toluene and benzene and formaldehyde and things like that. Acrolein, things, exposure to fumes from cars and things like that as well.
Scented candles and things that are all over the place. The fragrances that are there.
Scary. Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Very scary. We often don't even know the full extent, the damage that those scents do.
Absolutely.
Even though it feels like we want to be surrounded by pleasurable scents. You know, they're wreaking havoc on our body sometimes.
Please be careful. Yeah, over time. And then the third group is the biotoxins. So things like mycotoxins, trichothecines, gliotoxin, alpha-toxin, things like that, aflatoxin, and things like ochratoxin A, all of those can contribute. And the good news is, you know, many molds aren't making these toxins, but the kind of the classic ones, the Stachybotrys and Penicillium aspergillus, Ketomium walemia, those are the big five to be concerned about. So those are so it's inflammation, toxins. And then the other two are things that if you don't have enough of them, they're supportive things for your brain. And the first is energetics. So we have an equation, and in the denominator, in the numerator are the toxins and the inflammagens. In the denominator energetics, and trophic support. So for energetics, the big four things there, cerebral blood flow, oxygenation, so people who have sleep apnea, huge problem, huge increase in risk. Dropping your oxygenation is huge. And of course, you can check it easily on your, you can check it on an iPhone, or you can check it on a watch, or you can check it many different ways to check your oxygenation. Getting an oximeter and look at night, for example. The third part there is mitochondrial function that you guys, of course, talk so elegantly about frequently. And then the fourth one is the actual burnable, combustible substrate, which in this case, ketones. So as Stephen Kinane taught us all a number of years ago, you've got a gap there. When you have Alzheimer's disease, you've got poor glucose utilization. That is the signature, the hallmark on a PET scan for Alzheimer's disease, and even for 10 years before a diagnosis, is temporal and parietal reduced glucose utilization. Well, the good news is you can bridge that gap with ketones. So with the combination, and if you can develop metabolic flexibility so that you can now burn both the fats and the glucose, you're in the best shape. So we want to do both. And so you can see when someone has insulin resistance, they are causing their own cognitive decline by multiple mechanisms. They're creating inflammation because of the non-enzymatic glycation of hundreds of proteins. They're also causing a resistance to, so that you now have reduced trophic support from insulin. When we would grow brain cells in a dish, which we did for 30 years in the lab, you'd always have to include some insulin there because you needed that to keep the cells alive. It is a very important neurotrophic activity. Things like nerve growth factor, brain-derived neurotrophic factor, and insulin are all critical for keeping neurons alive. So you're having this second mechanism as well. You're also having a metabolic component there. You're now losing, you not only have the insulin sensitivity or insulin resistance loss, but you're having the trophic problem as well. So you have a metabolic problem, a trophic problem, an inflammatory problem. You're really ticking most of the boxes to give yourself cognitive decline when you have insulin resistance. And then I should say the fourth piece of this then, the third piece being the low energetics, the fourth part of this then is trophic support. And those come in three groups. So it is growth factors, as I just mentioned, things like insulin and things like NGF and BDNF. But secondly, it is hormones. So having, this is why estradiol in the past was noted to be a critical support, and a sudden loss of estradiol, as was shown by the Mayo Clinic group years ago. If you have a sudden loss of estradiol at the age of 40 or younger, and you don't get HRT, then you are doubling your risk for Alzheimer's. Even though the Alzheimer's isn't coming till the future, you are increasing your risk starting at that time. And then the third of those three is nutrition. And so getting appropriate vitamin D and appropriate omega-3s and all these things, huge. So you look at those groups, and you can add to that stress, which is another piece of this. It's really a part of the trophic and metabolic piece because of its effect on things like cortisol and DHEA and pregnenolone and things like that. But those are the big groups. If you can optimize those four main groups, you are going to do a tremendous amount with preventing and reversing cognitive decline. And on the other hand, simply throwing a single drug at what you can see as quite a complex problem really doesn't make any sense.
A declining mind is one of the scariest things one can imagine. Left unchecked, I've seen the devastating effects this process can have on individuals and their families. But we know that there's so much that can be done to prevent and even potentially reverse Alzheimer's and dementia if we get involved early enough. Thanks for tuning into this week's mini episode of the Drew Perrott Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, I'd love for you to leave a review, or even better yet, share it with a friend who cares about this topic. I'll see you next week.